Good morning, everybody. My name is Susan Potter, and our teacher this morning, Don Brown, is on his way. This is actually working out perfectly because it gives me a chance to explain the reading of this sutra, the Sugata Sutra, if I'm saying it properly. December and January is a month where the 2 months where we are going to kick off our or put positive energy into our annual fundraising campaign. And Rinpoche suggests that individuals and centers, as centers, read this sutra to create the conditions for successful finances. And without a reasonably strong financial base, this center would not be able to continue to open and have the teachings available. Here's our teacher right now. But we wanted to read the sutra. It's a little over 100 pages. We might not have quite 100 people, but we're going to read what we can, and then others of us will commit to read the rest of it throughout the week. So we're doing this cacophony style, which means that if everybody reads at the same time, we will have accomplished, I would say, at least 50 pages is going to get read this morning. And so if you read quietly but out loud, then we will have accomplished a good bit of the mission. Does everybody have a page of the sutra? Yes? Good. Thank you, Jackie. Okay, are you a good reader? Okay, good. Both of you. Excellent. If you see words, and this is really directed to the adults, but also the kids, if you see words in there that are long and unusual, which there will be on every page, they're strange words, sound it out the best you can and then just keep moving. We think this will take less than 5 minutes to read the whole sutra. Anything else I should add to this, Sarah? Robbie? Okay, I've given my page away, so I'm going to grab a page. No. Let me get a page. That way we'll have one more page read. Okay. And as people come in, they can continue to read their page. So this energy and effort is dedicated to a successful fundraising campaign for Kadampa Center for 2015. So with that, let's read the Sugata Sutra. Thank you. Thank you all so much. It really helps lessen the pressure of the six people on the Inspiring Generosity Committee to feel like the burden is now shared among the others of us who are also members. So thank you so much. You will be getting a mailing this week if you're a member or have donated. If you don't get something probably by the end of this week, next week you can be, we'll have extras here, sort of explaining what our goals are, what being a sustainer is, and how important it is to help support the Buddhist teachings and keep the center vibrant and growing. And so with that, I will thank you very much again. I really appreciate the help. Not just the help, creating the causes and conditions for this center to be successful. The committee is going to read the rest of the sutra, so we can do that, or I think that would probably be the best thing. We'll do that. I'll take them, Joey. Right. And then, but the ones that haven't been read, let me pick those up right now so we'll make sure that they're read throughout the week. Got it. Okay, thank you. Oh, you got him? Okay, good. Thank you. Would you pass that down?
Hello. So now we have the children here. So we can do our prayers and they can leave and go to their respective classes. So this is where I need help. We're going to do the prayers on page 34, right? We'll do everything in English. Nobody here speaks Tibetan, probably, so we'll just do it all in English today. And then we'll do the mantras, and I'll let Jill lead us in the tune to the mantras, since I have my own tune that's not the same one. Anyway, thank you. There's a lot of new people here, I'm sure, a lot of who's brand new, never been to Kadampa Center, new people. So be sure and go and say hi to these people if you get a chance. Just we are generally a friendly group, although, you know, we are. So we're going to do the prayers, and I always tell people, it's good to stop before you just jump into these prayers and think about what in the world do they mean. And so the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer, the very first one, it's like, there's a couple of things that you need to have. One is, you sort of have to believe at some level that you're sick. Anybody got a problem with that? Most of us are probably, I'm not sick, I'm fine, my mind's just great. But, you know, we don't have a lot of control over our minds. In fact, it's very easy for somebody to tag us, you might say. We all have our buttons. So in that sense, we're sick. We have work to do. I'll just put it that way. So, you know, that the first thing you need is to have some sense of wow, I have a crazy mind, and I would love to be able to rein it in and calm it and develop this good quality. So you have to have a sense of concern about how out of control your mind is, and then you have to have some confidence that the Dharma, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha actually provide a reliable source of guidance. So that sometimes the words faith or confidence, and all of this takes time. You know, you can't just pop in here the first day and all of a sudden have faith. You have to practice it over years, really, to experience the you know, any sort of profound shift in consciousness. But it is possible. So we want to start out with a proper motivation as we do these prayers. And the other motivation that's really important is the one that we had more time in the first class. But the other motivation that's really important is that we're here for others. And most of us didn't come here for others. We came here for me. Me, myself, and I. You know, I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. So on and so on. But, you know, the Mahayana perspective is we practice because we want to develop our qualities so that we can then really help others. We can be a perfect servant to others. So that's the kind of attitude that is not easy to come by, but it's something we can train our mind into over time. So as much as possible, those two attitudes as we read these prayers together. And if we put our hands together. Again, this is, people want to know what's going on. Usually we put our hands together at our heart. And the left hand symbolizes wisdom or female energy, and the right hand, anybody got a problem with that? Mostly women here. No, I don't either, actually. And the right hand symbolizes method, the principal one being compassion. So the union of method and wisdom at your heart. And you just, and that helps you come from your heart. When you put your hands at your heart, it helps you speak from your heart too. So we'll do these prayers together. I go for refuge into Lam Enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, to my practice of giving and other perfections. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge into Lam Enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering, and may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings until the end of psychic existence and the wheel of Dharma for living beings, and dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnu Yatayami, which means I send forth just this jewel mandala to you precious teachers, gurus. Now, we're going to do the mantras together, and now we have all of these pure beings here to my left, including Aaron, and we're going to, and so their mantras are going to be way more powerful than most of ours, probably. So we're all going to say it together at least seven times. So, huh? Sinrazik first and Taro second. Yeah. Seven times.
Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Tari tu re so ha. Om tari tu re so ha. Om tari tu re so ha. Tari tu re so ha. Om tari tu re so ha. Om tari tu re so ha. Om tari tu re so ha. Okay, now our little pure beings can leave and go to their classes. Thank you. Thank you for your attention, and y'all are so well behaved. I'm just always rejoice in good behavior. Subject today is our respect. We talked about this a little bit last week. I mean, I did mention this, and it's pretty profound subject. But you never see it. You never see the word respect in Buddhist texts. Hardly ever. But it's implied everywhere. So I brought a couple of things with me. But who has a, give me your Buddhist spin on, I know what I want to hear. What's the pedestrian spin on respect? Like, what do people, when they hear the word respect, what do you think about? Who's got the mic? Yeah, right? I want to hear the, you know, you, if you were working for WRAL and interviewing people on the streets, and you got interviewed. Just go interview somebody. Jill works for REL. She's going to interview David Strebel. David, would you stand up, please, so we can get a video of this?
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Is this thing on? Well, I think the simple definition of respect is that you care about what other people think and feel, and you treat them kindly.
Okay.
I think it's the song. R-E-S-P-E-C.
Aretha Franklin. She didn't make it tonight. Sorry.
Well, the pedestrian. Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just what you
think
about.
It's something that needs to be earned. I mean, the pedestrian definition. I'm sure you're going to tell me something different.
I think it's an acknowledgement of another person's positive attributes. It may be their integrity, it may be their honesty, their courage, or it may be their professional abilities, a physician or a scholar or whatever, or possibly even their position as a president of the United States or as a whatever.
Anybody. So do people... So do we, you know, we say he's worthy of respect, right? Don't we use that term a lot? Like, I want to be worthy of respect. she's worthy. We want to become somebody who's worthy. Anybody not want to be worthy of respect? Raise your hand if you don't care about being respected. No hands. So last week I talked a little bit about the eight worldly concerns. Remember those? The eight worldly dharmas, but for new people and for established people, you know, it's kind of a big deal. I mean, we don't think about it, but it's something we really want. The for example, in the first class I talked about it in prison. Andre does a lot of work in prisons and stuff. You know, I've seen this on TV. You know, this guy killed another guy in prison. Because he didn't, what? He didn't respect me. In other words, he killed somebody because he didn't get respect. Pretty big deal in that environment. But it's a pretty big deal in the whole world. So when we get in the eight worldly concerns, okay, the things that we really crave. And I'm talking about just ordinary people want more than anything. What do we want? We all, one great Thai teacher said, we are addicted to deliciousness. We want good things more than anything in the world. And what are we addicted to not having? The flip side. We are, in other words, the more we crave deliciousness, the more we crave not to experience yuckiness. Right? I mean, that's pretty clear. All right, so in Buddhism they have like a little list. Of course, there's always a list over here and a list over here. But the four things on this side that we talk about as the delicious things are gain, okay? So it could be material gain, it could be a relationship, money, job, you know, whatever. But gain. Then there's pleasure. We all want pleasure, right? We all want pleasure. Then over here, it's like a good reputation / respect. That's there in this list. And then the last one is we crave. I use the word approval. This sounds a little bit like respect, but it's what's another term for it, Robbie?
Fame.
Yeah, fame. Okay, but you can be famous for the wrong reasons. So what we really crave, and so the more I crave all of these things, gain, pleasure, respect, and fame, the more if I don't have them, well, I'm what? I'm like trying to get them, and if I get the opposite of it, what happens? If I get, what's the opposite of gain? Yeah, if you have a car and somebody steals it, wow, the more you're attached to your Maserati, yeah. Maserati, I saw somebody's sign, they had a little Mazda and they had their license plate said Maserati. But anyway, the more you're attached to your Maserati when somebody rips it off, the more you suffer. If you didn't care, it wouldn't make one iota worth of difference, would it? So the gain, that's the gain part. Pleasure. The more you're attached to pleasure, and you can, you know, you think, well, my relationship with my spouse or my whoever it is, or a good meal, or whatever you vacate, whatever it is that you see as pleasurable, and so many things that bring us pleasure. The more we're attached to pleasure, when we're not getting it, what are we trying to do? Get it. And when we get pain, the opposite, the more you're attached to this, the more you what? Hate that. You hate pain. I tell you, you know, people with a low pain threshold, you know, people over here, I've dealt with Eskimos and Tibetans and in a medical context, and I can tell you that people who are used to pain, they don't get rocked by it. And it doesn't affect them that much because they're not attached to pleasure because they don't get much, so they don't have much aversion to pain. I'm serious. I mean, I could tell you a story, but I won't bore you with it. But so attachment to pleasure creates an aversion to pain. It's not that there's anything wrong with pleasure, but it's just the attachment to it that creates suffering for us. And then the attachment to like being respected and a good reputation. Okay, the more we cling to that, when we don't have it, we're trying to get there, and we get disgraced when somebody bad mouths us. Like at school, somebody's talking bad about us, stuff like that. What happens? Ouch! It really hurts. Or you see yourself on the front page of the NNO for something that you did that was not right. I have two friends that's happened to, and it was very painful for them. At least I'm pretty sure. It wasn't totally true what was written, but the word was out, so that was it. And then the last one, the fame and approval and stuff like that. The more, we're all like this. We all want approval, don't we? We all want other people's approval. So when you don't have approval, we're always trying to go out and get it. We're like somebody with a little cup. Would you please give me some approval? I really want your approval. And then when you don't give it to me, and I don't get approval, I get disapproval. It really hurts. It's very painful. Please put some approval in my cup. Thank you. God, I feel better now. So, the more we crave these delicious things, the more uncomfortable we are when we don't have them, and the more we suffer when we get the flip side, which is the opposite. Now, of all of these things that are these four categories, the great teachers of this tradition say the thing that we crave the most is respect. Hence, I killed him. He disrespected me. I killed him. There was this. So I was reading this thing about the Hatfields and the McCoys and what went on in the, back in the mountains of western North Carolina and Tennessee, eastern Tennessee and all that. And this guy was doing something, and he some people were shouting obscenities to him, and he shot him, killed him, and they acquitted him. What kind of person would he have been if he hadn't killed him? They disrespected him. Now, this is in the good old days, back. But it's a big deal for us, being respected. So in the Buddhist teachings, if this is all I had to say, and I have a little bit more to say than that, but this is nothing new, is it? I mean, what I've said so far is very common sense, and we all know this. But in the Buddhist teaching, since you don't see it mentioned very often, let's try to see what the Buddha had to say about it. And I brought some texts that I'm particularly fond of. But one of them starts out, it's the foundation of all good qualities. And I think a lot of you have, some people have memorized it. It's the only place where I saw the word respect in any of the Buddhist teachings. But it's implied everywhere. And we'll talk about that in a minute. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind, this is the first stanza. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So in the context of Buddha Dharma, like it's really important to have respect for the teacher. And I'm not saying, I'm not like talking about me, necessarily. I'm talking about, any teacher of something spiritual that we find, helpful. And I'm particularly talking about people like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, because they're talking about the gurus. These are the people that are walking the talk, they're living the Dharma day and have committed their entire lives to transforming their minds into the Dharma. So having every text, I'll read, this is the three principal aspects of the path. The very first line is, I bow down to my perfect gurus. Again, it's about being respectful. The prostrations that we didn't do it, did we? But the prostrations that we do, you know, in Geshe Gelug here, and the first time we did them, the prostrations that we do are all about showing respect to the historical Buddha. Okay, we're acknowledging that. We're acknowledging our own potential. We're paying respect. Now, this sounds weird, the way I'm languaging this, but we're paying respect to our own potential to be a Buddha. We're paying respect to the Dharma, which is, you know, the ultimate Dharma are the realizations in the minds of these holy beings. So we're paying respect to that, because that took a lot of work to change, to transform their mind into the Dharma. So we pay respect for that. But we also pay respect to our own potential to, you know, to realize these teachings. And then we're paying respect to the spiritual community, those beings that can guide us into gaining these realizations, but also our potentials to become the Sangha, you know, the spiritual beings that guide others. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunities within Buddhism to practice respect. You know, anybody step on a book lately? I mean, if you put a book on the floor at Kadampa Center, what's likely to happen to it? Somebody's going to come and pick it up and put it on the table. Why? Because we try to, as part of our practice of respect, we try to keep the books off the floor. It's not that the books are going to be damaged necessarily. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. We don't even step over books. You know, we try to pick them up. Like if a book is in front of you, you know, this goes back 2,500 years as a discipline. I'm sure there was some practical reasons too, because nobody had shoes and your feet are the dirtiest part of your body and so on. But, you know, there was this practice, and still today, of holding the, you know, of keeping the text on the altar. They're the highest things. And when the teachers come in, you know, Geshe Gelug sits at this table, which is, you know, supposedly higher than all the other chairs here. And that's so we can pay respect, to, you know, as a way of honoring the teacher. So there's so many opportunities to practice respect. And I think so, respect for the teachers, respect for the Dharma, and so on, very, very important. But let's talk about something that's kind of interesting, I think. And it was in the last line of this book, the 16 Guidelines, and I disagree with it to the exact wording of it, but it said something, it was about 4 or 5 pages on respect, and it said, yeah, let's try to be the kind of person that's worthy of respect. Now, why would that be a problem? As a Buddhist, why would you have a problem with that? Yeah. Turn that on.
Because we all worth respect.
We all are worthy of respect. Why?
Because we all have this life, and everybody wants the same thing, has a happiness. And so we all are precious.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a precious human life, and we all deserve the love, kindness, compassion,
yeah,
which can be perceived as a respect to your fellow, to the person next to you.
Yeah. You know, and we talked about, yeah, that's exactly right. I wouldn't disagree with that. I'd just add to it, we all have Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm.
We all have, even insects. You know, my couple of my girls are here now, and we, early on, before they had a children's program, we used to go, as part of a practice of respecting all living beings, we used to go by crickets and worms out by Lake Wheeler. Every Sunday morning, we go by crickets and worms, and we go liberate them in the backyard. And the guy thought we were crazy because I was spending about $15 a week on crickets and worms. He thought I was a great fisherman or something. But we'd take them to the backyard and dig a hole, and we'd say some mantras. This is a little weird, I know, but and we liberate them because I, you know, it's, you know, I wanted from, you know, I, basically, we all do everything for ourselves. So let's be honest. I'm not this nice guy. I do it for me. But I do it. I wanted my kids to have the experience of cherishing everything that lives and to be respectful of life. Well, let's start with insects, okay, and worms. So we did that. So we still have that tradition at Kadampa Center. We call it animal liberation, you know, where you can liberate all kinds of little creatures usually. So, that's an important aspect of respect. So is everybody worthy of respect? Everybody's worthy of respect, but that doesn't necessarily mean what? Well, let's put it this way. We don't have to agree with what they do. What they're doing, to use an extreme example, if you're flying large jumbo jets into buildings, are you worthy of respect if you're doing that? According to what we just said, yes. But I don't agree with that. Or you're blowing yourself up to try to kill a whole bunch of other people. You know, extreme example again. That person is worthy of respect because they do have Buddha nature, but it's obscure, just like ours is, by layers and layers and layers of conditioning and confusion. But we're saying that everybody is worthy of respect. And I like what you said. If you look around this room, one reason we're worthy of respect, and this is the most powerful way to develop loving kindness, by the way, according to our teachers, is to understand, if you look around, you know something very intimate, and you guys know something very important about me, and I know something very important about you, and you, and you, and you, and you. Every one of us wants exactly the same thing, which is we want to be happy, and we don't want to suffer, and there's nothing wrong with that. Now, if you next time you meet somebody and you feel a little nervous or self-centered, just look at them and think, they're just like I am. They don't want to suffer, and they want to be happy. Now, again, we do it in a lot of bizarre ways and unskillful ways. We do things that are unskillful, thinking that's going to lead us to happiness. But the motivation of all of us, and we're exactly the same, even insects, they do not want to be crushed. They don't want to be smashed and die, you know. Animals, they don't want to die. They want to be happy, and they don't want to suffer. And we don't think about it very often. But if we have that if we have that understanding that everybody has Buddha nature, everybody wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer, we can bring an element of respect to the conversation, to the encounter. And then the last thing before I want to say one more thing, then I'm going to shut up. Is about self-respect. You don't hear that, do you? What about self-respect? What's something you hear people say? Don't you have any self-respect? Any self-respecting person would do that. Right? What else? Come on, what else do you hear? About self-respect? Show a little self-respect. What do we mean by that? What does that mean? Pardon? Let's hear from somebody else. Let's hear from the back of the room here. Let's get them in the game.
Treat yourself in a better way or honor your choices. Be kind to yourself, compassionate, honest.
Yeah, treat yourself with compassion and honesty. That's a great one. Boy, how many of us do that?
To treat yourself kindly when you were thinking about yourself and thinking about what you did. I think that's a hard thing to learn, is to be kind with your own thoughts to yourself.
Because
usually we tend to get into a series of self-blame and self-guilt and sometimes even very aggressive.
Like self, you're saying self-loathing, negativity, a lot. I mean, some psychologists have done studies that have, I don't know how they did this, but way more than half of our thoughts are negative, the ones that we're thinking about ourselves. So if we let that negative mind, if we, here's the problem. Is there a problem having a negative mind? It's just like attachment. Is anything what, does anybody hear me say attachment's wrong or bad? Did I say that? No. Did I say it causes suffering? Yeah. It is so clear. It is, this is not a debate. It is so clear that the more I cling to deliciousness, the more I'm going to be dissatisfied and unhappy. So, you know, having a negative mind, is that bad? Are we bad people for having negative thoughts? I mean, we can do bad things based on those negative thoughts. Like, for example, I think I'm going to kill that person. And then we believe that thought and we act on it. Or, God forbid, Buddha forbid, we think, okay, I'm going to take my own life. I don't deserve to live. It happens. It happens. Every day it happens. People take their own life. And it's not having the thought, I'm going to take my own life, that is the problem. It's believing it. So here's this is the function of ego. This is the function of ignorance in Buddhism. We project this false sense of I that we believe in so dearly. Me, I am this, and we have such a strong, concrete, strong belief in who we are. Like, and we also, if we check it up, we think we're the most important one in the world. We do. I am the center of the universe. Everything revolves around me. I mean, that's just instinctively how we operate. But we project this false sense of I, and then we believe it. It makes up enormous stories about how people mistreated me and how things went well and how things went really bad. And it's like a novel, but it goes on for 70 or 80 or 90 years. But we believe every word of it most of the time, particularly the negativity. It's kind of interesting how we glotch onto the negativity. You know, 10 people can tell you you're beautiful, and one person tells you you're ugly, and you believe them. Or, you know how I mean? It's like amazing. You get all this positive feedback, and then one little negativity, and somehow that really is the one that hits home. So, self-respect is, I think, a really big deal, and we don't talk about it. We don't use this kind of language. But it's like having self-respect is, if I said, I said, look, we all have Buddha nature. We all have the potential to get enlightened. How many people thought, not me? How many people thought that? Everybody. Raise your hand. Really? Hannah, raise your hand. Nobody, we don't think we have potential. We don't think we can do these things. We have what I call a spiritual inferiority complex. We don't think we can, we have this amazing potential. We don't have respect for our potential to be happier, more compassionate, kinder, wiser, more powerful, and more able to benefit and help others. We don't have that kind of self-respect. We constantly are putting ourselves down, and we have to begin to pay attention to that mind. And if we have self-respect, challenge it. When you hear yourself putting yourself down and saying, I am a totally bad person, and you hear that, and you start kind of, falling under the sway of that negative mind, why not confront it and say, no, that's not true. I sometimes I do stupid, bad things, but that's not who I am. I have this basic essence we call Buddha nature, and that's who I really am. I do dumb things, but I'm okay. I'm good enough. Like that. So I think we have to train ourselves, I think, to have self-respect. Now, I'm going to say something, and I don't think this is necessarily true. I haven't proven it to myself yet, but I'm considering it. That without self-respect, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to respect others. What do you think? Is that true, or this sounds good, doesn't it? Like, how can you love others if you don't love yourself? I'm not sure that's true either. But it sounds true. There's something that resonates about it, isn't it? makes some sense. That if we don't respect ourselves, we don't treat ourselves with kindness. I love what you said in the back. Like when we do dumb things, we beat ourselves up. We don't acknowledge that kind of like what we really need to do is like pat ourselves on the back and say, you know, there I did it again. Even laugh about it. Like, gosh, I just did the same thing. I've done it so many times. I need to have some compassion for myself. I'm this conditioned being caught in samsara. I've been doing the same thing over and over again for countless lifetimes. I just did it again. And and I can purify this and so on. So having compassion for ourselves, I think, is the ultimate expression of self-respect. I really think that's important. Okay, so we still have some time, or we'll wrap it up. We have 20 minutes, so I'd like to hear from other people because I've thrown a lot of stuff out.
I was just thinking about something that I had read that His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, had spoken or had expressed kind of unbelief when he first heard people talking about self-hating, and he didn't quite understand that, which suggested that there seems to be something about our Western culture that particularly reinforces self-loathing.
Yeah.
And I know from my own personal experience, I can think of, and I don't know how much this generalizes to other people, but as a kid, I grew up in a religious household that was really great in a lot of ways because it taught me about morality and so forth and so on. But one of the fundamental tenets of that religious belief was this thing called original sin, that you had inherited this defect,
right,
flaw.
Were you Presbyterian too?
No. But it's not just Presbyterians who have this. You know, this defect, this flaw,
yeah,
and that somehow or other, there was really nothing you could do about this, that the only thing that the only remedy for that was this external being, God, coming and bestowing grace upon you.
Yeah.
You could be as good as you want it to be. You just strive all the time, constantly aware of your limitations, the fact that you were really just horrible, supposedly because of something that the original two people did. And you could never really get rid of that.
I hear what you're saying. What about guilt? Guilt is another one that... What has anybody had issues with guilt? Raise your hand, everybody. George Dreyfuss, who's George is a professor at Williams College, and he's the head of the department or something like that now. But anyway, he came here many years ago to speak, and he said that Western cultures are guilt driven, and Asian cultures are more like shame driven. You know, the shame is more of a deterrent. But but if you really, and again, I'm not an expert. Yes, I am, come to think of it, on guilt. here's some things I've heard about guilt. So I'll give you the Buddhist spin on guilt, because it sounds real good if you can do it, but I still feel guilty, even though I've been trying to do this stuff for a long time. But when you do, guilt implies what? Guilt implies that there's somebody judging you, like the judge says, you're guilty. So it really does imply there's some external being, something out there judging us. And then when we're experiencing guilt, what is the mind doing? When you're feeling guilty, what are you saying to yourself? Pardon? Yeah, and what do you say? What's the conversation? I am a bad person. I am awful. In other words, we're not really addressing the behavior in guilt. We just basically feel like yuck, like original sin. Like, oh, that's I mean, I'm not, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I can tell you, when I look into my mind and I feel guilty, I feel terrible. And when I feel terrible, I'm talking about feelings. Usually I come up with a story that goes, I'm bad and wrong. You know, we're so feeling oriented. So when we feel terrible, we usually come up with a story that supports that negative feeling or that uncomfortable feeling. And usually it's a negative self-talk. Okay, so that's guilt. And you know, there's a cycle of guilt that, you know, I've heard this before from psychologists, that some people will be abusive, like to their spouses, you know, and then they go and apologize, and they turn around and do the same thing over again. Then they go back and apologize and do the same thing over again. It's like, it doesn't change anything. So guilt doesn't really even address the behavior. It's so self, you know, we're very self-preoccupied in a negative way with guilt. But let's go look at karma. This is the Buddhist view. If you do something that's harmful or destructive, what, you know, it's like these three guys that go into the bar. You want to tell it, Robbie?
Three monks go into the bar.
Yeah. This is an old Buddhist story. Three monks go into a bar, and then they're sitting at the bar, and they have their drinks in front of them. The first monk drinks his. He falls, the next guy drinks his, and the third monk is getting ready to drink his, or has just started to drink it. He sees the first guy fall over dead, sees the second one fall over dead, and he has just drunk the drink that's going to kill him.
Yeah.
How it goes.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. Yeah. That's a good example. So what do you think the guy who just took a sip feels guilty? You think he's beating himself up for that? No. He feels what? Regret. Like he goes, you know, he wants to throw it up. He doesn't want to die. He just poisoned himself. So according to the laws of karma, when we've misbehaved or behaved in a way that's been harmful to us or others, you know, this sort of feeling of guilt is not the appropriate response. What we regret is the action, because we're okay. You know, we really are okay. We do have Buddha nature. We do have, you know, amazing potentials. So we shouldn't be putting ourselves down, but we should definitely address the behavior. And so from the view of karma, when we've misbehaved, the appropriate response is regret. And then from regret, regret's one of what? Four opponent powers. That's part of purification. That's how we clean our mind up. We go, oh, God, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have gotten angry at my significant other, or I shouldn't have stolen that, or I shouldn't have lied, or I'm so sad I did that. You know, we have to be, in other words, and people, I don't know if anybody here has been in AA, but in AA, you know, I've heard that the very first thing that happens in AA is people go, you're supposed to take a brutal inventory of your lives, of your actions in your life up until that moment, and go back, and unless it's going to create huge havoc, clean it up. Go back and apologize to people. In other words, develop sincere regret for the harm that you've done yourself and others, particularly others in this case. So it's very difficult to transform the mind if we're operating on a foundation of regret. And what's the biggest cause of regret? It's behaving in non-virtuous ways. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, all the actions of body and speech that we, you know, we really need to pay attention to our behavior and rein it in. They say when you're trying to develop single-pointed concentration, which is very, very important as a meditator, if you ever want to make any progress, the first thing you have to do is behave impeccably. Because if your mind is full of regret, that's all that'll be coming up. You won't be able to find any peace of mind. So this is in our best, it's in our own self-interest to behave ethically and to purify our negativity. So, in other words, Now, we started out with respect. Did I get way off base here? No, I don't think so. I think we're still within the realm of respect. You know, if we respect ourselves and others, see, this is important. How is it disrespectful for me to kill somebody? Because what have I just done? Created the causes to get killed. Maybe not in this life, but in some future life. And have bad health and all the rest. You know, if I steal, is that disrespectful to me and somebody else? Absolutely. And not only do people like to be stolen from, no, you don't steal from people you respect, but I just disrespected myself. I just created causes to be stolen from. Sexual misconduct. If I behave that way, I create the cause to be cheated on, and I don't want that. You know, so being really rigorous with our behavior, our actions of body and speech. The mind is, let's forget about the mind. It's going to be lifetimes before we can rein that in. But as Venerable Robina says, just, what did she say, Robbie? Button up and keep your hands to yourself. Zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself. So, you know, we can control our body and our speech. The mind takes a lot of work. It'll take time to do that. But it's to be respectful. And so I wanted to read one last thing, and then we'll just wrap it up. Does anybody have anything else to say? Yes, please.
I have a question. What if you do something by accident you didn't mean to do? What would the Buddhists say? So the content is that I think I hit a squirrel by accident. What would Buddhists do?
WWBS. What would Buddha say? What would Buddha say? Hello, anybody, any Buddhists out here who want to take that one on? In the back, right behind you.
So, can you hear me?
Yeah.
So you have to, in order to receive the karma or merit for the action, it has to have both intention and action, correct?
Yes. Yeah. If the intention to, this is interesting. At the time of the Buddha, there were plenty of blind people that took monastic vows, and walking meditation was and still is a big part of Buddhism, particularly in the Theravada tradition. Well, if you're walking around and you're stepping on insects and stepping on worms and whatever else, you could be killing, but you have no intention to kill, so you don't get the full karma of killing. There's something there that may be. There's a debate about it. I'll put it to you that way. But if your intention, well, we know, for example, in a court of law, is there's first degree murder and there's second degree murder, right? You know, if you had no, or I don't know, maybe third degree too, but you know, if you premeditated intentional murder, it holds a greater sentence than if it's accidental or sort of whatever. I don't know much about law, but anyway. You know what I'm saying? So the intention is the key point, the key factor. Yeah.
On self-respect, I often hear it used in the context of holding yourself to higher standards.
Right.
So ensuring that you're aligning your life with nobler principles. And I can see where in our society, you know, we have the principles of success. And, you know, what is going to make you happy in our society are completely in line with what actually, according to Buddhist thought, will make you happy, right? So consumerist, capitalist societies are misaligned with that completely. So you could see where, I could see where there, you know, in many cases, you could have self-loathing and self-hatred because you're so lost. You're aligning your life with these things that are supposed to make you happy, and you have no concept of how to get back to where, you know, to align yourself with what principles actually will make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
You constantly live in a state of that sense that you're doing something wrong all the time.
Yeah.
That you're always misaligned. And
right.
In that case, I could actually see to an earlier question you had where if you don't have self-respect, you could actually respect another because you can actually put that person ahead of you because you live in such a state of misalignment.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. And I'm not saying that, you know, we do, I think we all have some self-respect. You know, I just think that we have work to do. We're a work in progress, yeah. How are you holding them? Well, it's your turn. It's karmic. You have to speak now. I'm just kidding. Yeah, one more over there. Let's hear from some people that have been quiet. Oh, okay.
I have a question for you. So we talk about karma, cause and effect. I come from India, so I understand shame also, and East is shame and West is guilt. I understand all of that. So what, and I know somebody in India who's severely depressed, who is not nice to his spouse, and he's just mentally sick, and he never got the help that he's needed, and he created a lot of bad karma. In reality, it might look like that he's a bad person, but in truth, he's mentally sick. So what about his karma?
What about his karma?
Yeah, his karma is bad, but he's still a good person.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all that way.
So what will happen to his future, his next life?
It depends. That's a great question for another day. But, you know, we're all that way. We all do bad things, and, you know, we all create bad karma, but we're good people. Even the people that flew into the World Trade Center or they're blowing themselves up for the wrong reasons, they just got a bad teacher. They got confused, but they're not bad people. You know, look at Milarepa, this great Buddhist saint who killed 30-some people. It might be 36. He killed 36 people before he ran into Marpa and got his act cleaned up and turned out in that very lifetime that he'd murdered so many people, he actually achieved enlightenment. So, you know, I'm sure that Andre tells that story in the prison. That nobody's hopeless. We all have Buddha nature, so we all have the potential to grow it and to become, you know, happier. I mean, that's what we, and not happier just because we want to be happy, but, you know, again, the Mahayana perspective is, how can I help others? Well, be happy. That's a great contribution to give others. Just don't harm them and help them if you can. That's kind of the essence of Buddhism. If you can help them, help them, but at least don't hurt them.
Doesn't it bring suffering to others, like the people who hit the World Trade Center? They were not, they had Buddha nature, but their actions brought so much suffering to others. So how do the people who are suffering deal with that?
I didn't summarize that question.
So you said that people who hit the World Trade Center, they still had the Buddha nature, but their behavior was wrong.
Right.
And that led to so much suffering in the life of other people.
And especially them. Especially them. Think of the karma of killing that many people.
But in reality, they are not aware of that, right? They are conditioned.
They don't understand karma, evidently.
So how can they be responsible for that?
Because karma doesn't care. Karma doesn't care. Karma's like gravity. You know, karma's like this. Bang. It's impersonal. Whether you see, as Buddhists, and most people align with the, you know, even in prison, what goes around comes around. In the Bible, what you sow, you reap. If you don't brush your teeth, you get cavities. I mean, we have so many examples of what, you know, of actions and results. But Buddhism takes it to the further success. It says everything, every moment of every day, 24/7, we're creating the cause for either future happiness or suffering. It's completely up to us. We're shaping our future by the choices we make right now. Yeah.
I think, and now I'm thinking, I was trying to reinterpret what she was saying, but now I'm just confused. But I was trying to get at the concept of hitting the squirrel accidentally. There was no intent to hurt that being. But for the people who flew the planes into the World Trade Center, they did have intent to hurt others, but they were sure that they were doing the right thing. But now I'm confused. So the karma with the squirrel, she had no intent of hurting the squirrel, so there's very little negative karma. They have accrued tremendous negative karma that will play out in another lifetime.
This is the Buddhist perspective. But, you know, let's get down to reality here. And let's say, you know, we can talk about World Trade Center and stuff like that, but what about you? What about me? About our mind? How did we handle that? You know, can we be respectful of people that harm other people and not sort of, what do you call it, the Venn diagram? He has Buddha nature, but he did something wrong. And ordinarily, you know, we focus on the negativity. We don't focus on the fact that they have Buddha nature. And we diss them. We diss them. So the whole world is full of people we diss all the time. And what I'm trying to, by the way, today is just the beginning. This last week's been very interesting for me. How many people have seen any pink Volkswagens this week?
What?
Pink Volkswagens. No? You saw a pink Volkswagen? Oh my God, where was it? Well, see, you're so lucky to see one because most people never see them. But if you think, okay, this next week I want you to look for pink Volkswagens, guess what you'll do? You will start to see them. They'll pop up in places you never saw them before. And this next week, what I hope we're doing now is making a distinction here called respect. Let's try to look and see where it's missing and put it in our own lives in terms of self-respect and respect for others. And I'll finish this conversation with something that happened yesterday. So I was going to two places yesterday. This is a story about Boston Market and Chick-fil-A, just to give you a little heads up. So going to Boston Market to pick up some food for my older children, and the lady that was at the window, you know, had gotten the order, and when she was handing it to me, she literally, like, didn't even look. She handed it to me and looked the other way. And I said, thank you, not a word. But another lady comes up and brings me the rest of the food and hands it to me. No smile on her face. No, it was like I wasn't there. Handed me the food. I said, thank you again, not a word. So that happens. I drop the kids off and I take the younger one. We go to Chick-fil-A. You go through the line of Chick-fil-A. What do they say when you're in line at Chick-fil-A? Yes. What do they say again? Oh, they say, my pleasure, drive around, you know, but it's my pleasure to serve you. Then when you check out, they look you right in the eye. They don't turn away from you. And they thank you for coming and say, what do they say? Have a nice day. Have a nice evening. They really show us, and I was talking to my girls, I said, look at, you know, when we were at Boston Market, I said, look at this. This is, like, not good compared to Chick-fil-A. At Chick-fil-A, I'm not, you know, let's not talk about politics here in Chick-fil-A, but people are, they're kind. They really made an effort to be respectful, and I appreciated that. And they've even won awards for this. And Disney, too, by the way, and it shows up as cash in the register. Who doesn't want to be treated with respect? You know, so it's just little things every day, you know. If you sit at a table with your family and everybody's playing with their cell phones, that's not respectful. And I use this example too when Lam Yeshe, when I first met him back in 1978, and I took refuge with him. But first time I met him, he was interesting. But he was funny. He was like, Lama Zopa was a bad cop, he was a good cop. He was like a stand-up comedian. And he was very funny, very sort of charismatic. But when he would sit there in front of people would ask questions, and he would like, there'd be 200 people in there, but he would be 100% focused on the person. That's respect. That's really what we all want. And we have to give it to get it. And I really think we have to work on our own heart and mind to be able to truly get that. We got to get away from it. We got to get outside of ourselves to be with other people to truly be respectful. So we got to work. It really does tie into the Dharma. So here's the eight verses. I do have one more thing. Listen to this. Every one of these has to do with respect. The term is to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. I'll hold them most dear at all times. That's respect. When in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. Respect. Vigilant the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, anger, fear, jealousy, you name it, I shall confront it and avert it without delay, because I don't want to harm myself, I don't want to harm others, and so on. So there are the eight verses of mind training all have to do with respect. So even though the term respect is not like, you know, you don't see a lot of teachings on respect, it's really important. So look for pink Volkswagens and respect, and look at that this week and really try to see how important that is, how much you want it, and then give other people your attention and give them kindness and give them whatever they want and need, and let's practice being respectful, because I think it really will matter in a very practical way. So let's do the dedication verses. Now, what page are the dedication verses on? 36. And then what's that prayer that we like to... Shanti Deva's prayer is on 2-something.
246.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll do the dedication prayers just top to bottom, and then we'll do Shanti Deva's prayer, and then we'll finish with Green Tara Mantra for Geshe Gelug's long life. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, there you are the source of all happiness and good. O powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of non-objectifying compassion, Manjushri, master of stainless wisdom, Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire host of Maras, Sankapa, crown jewel of the sages of the land of snows, to you, Losandrapa, at your feet I make request. And we're not doing four measurables, so we'll do, let's go to page 246 and do Shanti Deva's prayer. May all beings everywhere plagued by the sufferings of body and mind attain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains and for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay, so thank you for... Now I'd like for... Dharmas, yes. Okay. Go ahead, Robbie. Start it out. Tu tare tu re so ha. Om tare 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 tu tare tu re so ha. Tu tare tu re. Just keep going. That's okay. Now, one last thing. Kadabha Center has been, people have accused the Kadabha Center of being filled with introverts who just want to sit in a dark room and, you know, be quiet, and that's just a joke. No, nothing wrong with it. I'm one of them sometimes. It's okay. But today, I'd like for people to just turn around and introduce yourself to at least one other person, and you can say like they do at the yeah, you can't all introduce yourself to Robbie, by the way. But introduce yourself to one other person, and you can just say your name and something like peace be with you, or may you have happiness and the causes of happiness, whatever.
What's your name again? Thank you for your contribution.